KUOW podcasts are made possible by listener support. Become a new or renewing member today at KUOW.org.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. In 1989, Bill McKibben wrote what was considered the first book on climate change for a general audience. More than two decades after The End of Nature, McKibben is still advocating for the environment. He's been a main player in the fight to stop the Keystone Pipeline, and he focuses this talk on climate change in the Northwest. He spoke at the Queen Anne United Methodist Church on April 28, 2013, as part of the Well Lecture Series.
It really is good to be here. I am afraid you are not getting me at my absolute best, so it's sort of good. I know a fair number of people in this room. There's a number of people, and so I sort of feel a little bit like I'm with family. And so it's okay, maybe a little bit, if I preached this morning at Riverside Church in New York, which is the, among other things, the tallest church in America, and quite a beautiful place, but it has nothing on this. This is a gorgeous sanctuary here, too, and I love this. Butterflies hanging down in the middle, and it's just nice to be here. And to be able to say thank you to the mayor and be able to help a little bit with the fights that you all are engaged in. And I thought maybe what might be useful would just be to bring you up to date a little bit on where we are in the science and where we are in the politics and kind of what's going to come next. Do I have a clicker to control those slides or not? Okay. Then just go on to the next one, the blank one, and leave it there for a minute. Well, let's get the bad news out of the way first. We're completely screwed in all kinds of ways. Having written the first book about all this stuff 25 years ago, it's not that I was not unprepared for global warming to kick in, but everyone, all the scientists, were unprepared for how quickly and on what scale it would kick in. We've raised the temperature 1 degree Celsius thus far. It's not that much. It's about 3/4 of a watt of extra solar energy per square meter of the Earth's surface that we're trapping. Less than a small white Christmas tree light per square meter, but there are, in fact, a lot of square meters on the surface of the Earth. And so when you add it all up, it's the energetic equivalent. I think Jim Hansen calculated recently of about 400,000 Hiroshima-sized bombs going off daily, the extra energy that we're trapping. And so that energy's starting to do big things. The biggest thing it's done so far, maybe, is pretty much melt the Arctic. The new cryosat data that came out two weeks ago now shows that there's only about 20% of the summer sea ice left in the Arctic that was there 40 years ago. That's not a good sign. I mean, there are only so many large physical features on the planet, things that you can kind of see from outer space, and when you begin breaking them, that's not good. And of course, the other ones aren't that far behind. The ocean is about, all the oceans are about 30% more acidic than they were 40 years ago, and y'all are already seeing the effects here and the ability of things like oyster farmers to keep their crops growing, but if you think about that, you quickly realize that we only know about that because someone's actually kind of counting and selling and whatever. I mean, if it's happening there, it's happening all up and down the marine food chain. And of course, on land, what we see most is the change in hydrology. Warm air holds more water vapor than cold. The atmosphere is 5% wetter. So that's a big change. And it means that the dice are loaded for drought and for flood, and that's what we see place after place all over the world. Every day now, someplace it's going on. Houston, Texas got 7 inches of rain in 2 hours yesterday. And then it followed with, I mean, some parts they had a hailstorm so intense that their pictures, video up now, of this river of hail sort of washing away down through. The week before that, it was Buenos Aires. a rainstorm so severe, the governor called it a tsunami of rain, more than they'd ever measured before. 50-some people apparently died in their cars, and as the water rose. By now, sort of biblical scale bizarreness almost on a daily basis. And since we're in church, worth noting that the people who get hurt the worst and the first are the people that we're called upon most to try and protect. The least among us, the poorest people on the planet, are the earliest victim. Not that by now it isn't sort of affecting everyone, but, think about, say, Superstorm Sandy come roaring up the East Coast last fall, and it was a big storm, and we paid attention to it. You know, the lowest barometric pressure ever recorded north of Cape Hatteras, and the largest wind field we've ever measured, the wind, tropical storm force winds 1,040 miles out from the eye, and all of that. And of course, it did horrible damage in New York and New Jersey, and it should have given anybody pause. I mean, the idea that our technologically advanced civilization is invulnerable to this sort of thing should have been kind of laid to rest by the sight of seawater pouring into the New York City subway system. But the place that got hit the worst from Hurricane Sandy was Haiti. More people died there than died in New York. There's still a cholera outbreak underway. They lost something like 40% of their crops as that storm blew through. And the same all over the world. You know, it was the year before that that floods in Pakistan were so intense that 20 million people were out of their homes. The Indus River was covering a quarter of the country. Our drought last summer in the Midwest, when it was too hot to grow corn on the richest farmland in the world, that drought was a problem for farmers there, but of course they all had crop insurance and the federal government and things to back them up. It was a real problem for poor people in the rest of the world. If you have to get up in the morning and find enough coins to go to the market and buy cornmeal to make tortillas with for your family that night, a 30% increase in the price of corn was the biggest thing that happened in your world last year, you know. And of course, the scary part is we're barely at the beginning of this saga. We've raised temperature 1 degree, but the same scientists told us that would happen are quite robust in their prediction that it'll go up 4 or 5 degrees before the century is out unless we get off coal and gas and oil far more quickly than any government currently plans. And we can't deal with temperature increases like that. The agronomists at, there's a great study from Stanford and UW 3 years ago now, that found that from this point on, every degree increase in global average temperature should cut grain yields about 10%. So if the temperature goes up 2 or 3 degrees, the number of calories on the planet could go down 20 or 30%. I mean, we saw how that could happen looking at the Midwest last summer. Try to imagine an Earth like that. You all know enough about this planet to be able to guess what that means for any of the things we care about on this Earth. It's gotten very basic. The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration released a report in January saying that it's already hot and muggy enough that the ability of humans to do outdoor labor has been cut 10% already, and that by mid-century that'll be closer to 30% on current trends. Doesn't get much more basic than that. So, that's all the bad news. You can take a breath, and I will take a breath. The good news is, maybe, that we're starting to figure out how to rise to this occasion. I mean, a good logical question is, given that scientists have been telling us this for 25 years, and given that economists have basically told us what we need to do to prevent it, put a price on carbon that reflects the damage it does in the atmosphere. A very good question is why we haven't done it yet. What's going on? And it's not for lack of talking about it. Those scientists and those economists have trooped up to Capitol Hill every year for the last 25 years. I think my friend Jim Hansen, who retired a couple of weeks ago from NASA, I think he's been up there 50 times, and each time patiently explaining what's going on. And the result has been a 25-year bipartisan effort to accomplish nothing, and it's been entirely successful. And the reason is the astonishing power of the fossil fuel industry to block any change. They are the richest enterprise in human history. Exxon made more money last year than any company in the history of money. And it's all that they think about is, I'm not making this up. The CEO of Exxon, Rex Tillerson, went on the Charlie Rose interview program a couple of weeks ago. And Charlie Rose asked him, a series of fairly softball questions. And the most softball, he leaned in that avuncular way and said, "Tell me, what is your philosophy?" And I think he was expecting that the CEO of Exxon would come up with some interesting answer about serving the world's development needs or something. And instead, the CEO of Exxon thoughtfully looked into the camera and said, "My philosophy is to make money." He said, period, end of story. So high marks for honesty, And it would behoove the rest of us to pay attention to that and understand that that means that unless we interrupt this particular game, the same thing will keep happening that's been happening for a long time. Reason and scientific precision can't stand up to all that money. It certainly hasn't yet. And so it is incumbent upon us to figure out other currencies to work in, to find things that can stand up to it. And the only things I can ever think of are the kind of currencies of movements, passion and spirit and creativity. Sometimes one needs to spend one's body too, And that's the good news, that's begun to happen in a serious way.
Bill McKibben, an environmental activist and the author of more than a dozen books on the environment. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Bill McKibben in a moment. 819 94.9 KUOW. The Council of Canadians says it will vigorously dispute TransCanada's decision to move forward with its Energy East pipeline project. Also, former NSA contractor Edward Snowden has finally left the Moscow airport. His Russian lawyer tells us what lies ahead for his client. Investigative journalists have discovered that the confessions of a Swedish serial killer were false. Now, all of his convictions have been overturned, and observers are debating the legitimacy of yesterday's elections in Zimbabwe. All of these items tonight at 11. Weather outlook for the Seattle area for tonight: lows around 60, cloudy, chance of showers. Friday highs mid to upper 60s, cloudy with a chance of showers. Friday night, lows 50s to lower 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers in the evening. Saturday highs around 70, cloudy in the morning, becoming partly sunny.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Bill McKibben has called on world leaders to reduce carbon in the atmosphere to 350 parts per million. That's the highest amount scientists agree is safe. McKibben has been advocating for the environment for more than 20 years, and he's the author of more than a dozen books. He's also the founder of 350.org, which he speaks about next.
We started 350.org 5 years ago now, this past winter. Seems like more than 5 years, I confess, but 5 years ago. And of course, we took the odd name from what the scientists, particularly Jim Hansen, his team had just published a paper saying the most carbon you can safely have in the atmosphere is 350 parts per million. Beyond that, it's not compatible with the planet on which civilization developed and to which life on Earth is adapted, which is fairly strong language. And the bad news is, of course, that we're already well past that. Sometime in the next week or 10 days, the CO2 detector on the side of Mauna Loa, the most important scientific instrument in the world, set up in 1959 by Charles Keeling, it'll tick past 400 parts per million for the first time in human history, for the first time in much longer than human history. And on we go. So that, you know, when we heard that news, it was not, I mean, it was depressing. The paper that Hansen wrote was depressing. But it did give us an idea about how we could organize the world. The thing we were most worried about was that, how can you talk to everybody on the planet because they all speak different languages? But Arabic numerals, of course, get around this problem. 350 means the same thing in Seattle and in Saigon, you know, so we went to work. When I say we, in this case, at the beginning, it was myself and seven undergraduates at Middlebury College, where I teach. We had no money, which should have probably concerned us, and no, you know, list or anything, but we were, you know, we didn't know enough not to know what we shouldn't be doing. And anyway, there were seven undergraduates, and there are seven continents, so each one took one, and off we went to work. And the guy who got the Antarctic also had to take the internet, and it's only fair, and we went to work, you know, and our work, well, our work was really sort of what I'm doing tonight. It was to find other people like ourselves around the world that we could convince to pitch in. And not everywhere is there something called an environmentalist, you know, but everywhere there's somebody worried about development or women's issues or hunger or war and peace or the things you can't have on a planet that's just disintegrating. So they were the natural allies, and we asked everybody, including people here in Seattle who did a great job. We take this first day in the fall of 2009, and everybody come together to help, please, figure out something to do. We had no idea if it would work. We got the sense that it was going to work 2 days beforehand. When we were sitting around our little office, borrowed office, around a table, we had one table, eight of us there with our laptops open, and the phone rang, satellite phone rang, and it was our leader in Ethiopia. Like everybody else, like me, still a volunteer in this work, and like many of our leaders, she was 17, and she was in tears, and she said, the government took away our permit for Saturday. We can't do our thing then. We're going to do it today before they can stop us, which was brave, but that wasn't why she was in tears. She was in tears. She just kept saying, we so want to do this the same time as everybody else. We don't want to spoil it for everybody. We want to be part of the whole big thing. And she said, and here we can show the slide, I think, and she said, we do have 15,000 kids right now out in the street in Addis Ababa, chanting 350. So I was, you know, I was like, wow, don't worry about the date, it's okay. And on we went. And we can just flip through a few of these pictures. For the next 48 hours, you can just go through if you want here. The picture of those American soldiers in Afghanistan. One of the things to note as you go through, and you can stop on this one for a minute. One of the things that's really important to me, over the next 48 hours, there were 5,200 demonstrations in 181 countries. CNN called it the most widespread day of political activity in the planet's history. And the thing that was important to me to note, because I had always heard my whole life that environmentalism was something that rich white people did, it turns out actually that's not true at all. I mean, in fact, the biggest obstacle in the way of human progress at the moment is rich white people. Most of the people that we were working with around the world were poor and black and brown and Asian and young, because that's mostly what there is, you know. And the future bears down hard on them, so they are more than willing to go to work. And, you know, it was beautiful to see. I mean, that's someplace on the Congo River above Kinshasa where Conrad, in his Eurocentric way, identified the heart of darkness on our planet, you know. They're poor. They didn't have a digital camera. The picture they developed it in someone's home darkroom didn't come out so well, so they wrote in what their banner had said. But there they were, you know, taking part in this whole thing. And if you go on, you can see some of the other... it's very... lots of creativity. And lots of, this is a good picture, lots of involvement of religious communities for the first time in this kind of work. There's the, you know, biggest evangelical college in the country. Stop there for a minute. I'd been to Bethlehem to do some organizing, so not an easy place to get to, but the Dead Sea is shrinking very rapidly as temperatures rise. Everybody wanted to do something. Too many military checkpoints in the way to really, you know, so the Jordanian said, we'll make the 3 on our shore. The Palestinian said, we'll do the 5 on our beach. The Israeli said, we'll take care of the 0. It was a good thing to see, you know, very nice. Um, 300 demonstrations across China, important place to be doing this work. Police busted up one of them, but the others went off, and it was good, you know. Those are our allies in the Maldives. Maldives in the Indian Ocean, beautiful archipelago, highest point in this. I mean, this country's 5,000 years of continuous human habitation, but the odds of 5,100, I'm afraid, are pretty slim because the highest point in the whole country is about 1.5 meters above sea level, okay? So not good. But this was the biggest story on Google News for about 36 hours, and I think the reason is that people didn't look the way that people expected environmentalists to look. The next picture is from Yemen, which is a tough place. All the women in that 0 are wearing full black burqa, okay? So to us, they don't look like members of the Sierra Club, but their, you know, hearts are in exactly the same place. They're thinking about the future. They're thinking about other people. They're thinking about something beyond themselves, you know? It's oil-rich Abu Dhabi. There are oil-rich sheikhs down front, but smarter than some of your other oil-rich sheikhs, because there behind them is the edge of the largest solar array on planet Earth, all right? So that's good. There were 300 or 400 pictures that just ended up in a file called 350 Adorable. And they really were adorable, and they're also hard to look at. I mean, those girls probably be refugees someday through no fault of their own. So we've kept doing it, and you can just flip through these pictures real fast, Katie. Just boom right through them. We've kept doing these work all over the world. We've had 4 of these big global days of action, and Seattle's always been a huge help and in the lead. We've done about 20,000 rallies in every country on Earth except North Korea, and it's been wonderful and exciting and beautiful, and it's spread this message in lots of places where people didn't know about it. Just keep going there, and there'll be another one come. And it's been very exciting and good and useful work, and I've enjoyed every minute of it. And sometimes we've done huge art projects. That Tom York, a Radiohead, you go back one, Tom York of Radiohead, assembled 3,000 of his closest friends there in blue raincoats to make an image of King Canute trying to hold back the rising tide. We're making pictures so big, there's so many people in the next one from the DR that we had to, the only way to take a picture was to borrow a satellite for the day, you know. And, same, you know, just beautiful big images. That's scarab beetle, there's polar bear. That one stopped there, that one's a dry riverbed in Santa Fe, and when the satellite came over, just thousands of people put blue sheets up over their heads to kind of try and bring it back to life for a minute. And they, so stop there. All that educational work's incredibly important and really good. And I've loved doing it, and I think it's vital and all of that, but I also think it's not enough. All the time we were thinking, as we build this movement, we've got to build it to the point where it can start to take serious action, and that's what we've been trying to do. And in a sense, that really began with this fight against this Keystone Pipeline, which nobody had heard of in the spring of 2011, except the people who live up in Alberta, the native people whose lives have been turned upside down, and except a few people along the route, mostly in Nebraska, ranchers who were upset at their land being taken by eminent domain and worried about the danger, as they should be, of spills into the Oglala Aquifer. But nobody else had heard of it. And then Jim Hansen put out a little paper saying, you might want to pay attention because those tar sands in Alberta are the second largest pool of carbon on Earth. If you could burn them all off tonight, the atmospheric concentration of CO2 would go overnight from 400 parts per million to 540 parts per million, just from that one place, you know, never mind the Middle East or Venezuela or Australia or China or anything else, just there. So we, though everybody said the odds were impossible, we decided to at least make a little fight of it. And I wrote a note asking people if they'd come to Washington and get arrested, because we figured that it might take the power of civil disobedience to draw attention to it. And to our surprise, and everybody else's surprise, a lot of people, well, actually the most surprised were the police, who were used to dealing with, you know, three or four people at a time doing this. But on the first day of this two-week thing, there were 80 or 90 of us showed up. And so the police said, well, we're not going to do what we usually do, which is just take you to the police station in handcuffs and fine you $100 and let you go. You guys are going to go to jail for a while so we can try and deter the rest who are coming. And so we got to spend 3 days in Central Cell Block in D.C., which is as much fun as it sounds like it might be. But you know what? Not the end of the world. The end of the world's the end of the world. And that's why we're sort of doing this stuff. And it was actually really powerful. And it didn't do what the police had hoped. The logic that probably works fairly well with criminals appears to backfire with idealists, you know. And so people just kept coming. And before the 2 weeks were over, 1,253 people had been arrested, the largest civil disobedience action about anything in 30 years in this country. And you can flip through a few of these pictures there. Flip right past that one. Yes. Keep going. And this spread all over the world, you know, and the Canadians are getting, we all our friends and all around the world. And then we went back to the White House and surrounded it with 15,000 people. We can stop there, five deep. And it was really beautiful and really great. And actually, in a way, worked. I mean, the president, 4 days after that, said, okay, we'll stop for a year and evaluate or take another look. I mean, and there were people who said, this is sort of cynical because it just takes it past the election, and you know, and maybe they were right. But it did stop it for a year so far, really, by now 18 months, which means we've kept about 500 million barrels of the dirtiest oil on earth in the ground for that period of time, which isn't enough to win the fight, but it's not nothing either, you know. And And now the fight's back on in a big way. As you all know, last week we submitted 1 million public comments to the State Department. That was pretty good. And 2 months ago, 3 months ago, some people in this room were there. We had the largest environmental rally, climate rally ever in this country, on the Mall in Washington with 50,000 people out there, to show that no one had forgotten about this pipeline, and it was great. I don't know how it'll come out. It's a hard fight. The oil industry has all the money. The Koch brothers own huge leases across those tar sands in Alberta. These guys will spend what it takes. We've been very effective job creators. It's been, in essence, a full employment act for lobbyists in Washington, going to work for the oil industry to try and push this thing through. And they may win. May not, too. But it's helped spawn all kinds of other fights, and I think sort of help people understand that it's time to take these guys on. And so up in Canada, people have blocked and really blocked the proposed pipeline to the coast of British Columbia. It's not going to get built. With First Nations people in the lead and all kinds of everybody else behind them, they've blocked it. And you know what? I think that people in this part of the Pacific Coast are going to block those proposed coal ports. I really do. Of the 5 proposed coal ports, 2 are dead already. And that's good, because every time that we knock another one off, it lets us concentrate that much harder on the ones that are left, you know. I don't think they're going to get built. People are, I think, maybe passing around the, if there's anybody here who's not part of Power Past Coal, you should be, because you guys have the absolute historic opportunity to be a real... to be a significant pain in the ass to the fossil fuel industry. They cannot get their stuff out of Montana and Wyoming. There's huge coal, as big as the tar sands. They can't, Jill, are you passing that around? Good. They can't get that out if they can't get it past you guys. I mean, that's just the long and the short of it. If you block those coal ports, then that coal is going to, much of it's going to stay in the ground. And if you can do it, if we can keep it in the ground for 3 or 4 or 5 more years, well, it'll never get burnt, because sooner or later the planet is going to realize that it's in the process of committing some kind of strange suicide. And at that point, we'll wake up. So our job, those of us who already know that, is to keep things as where they are for the short run, so that in the long run it'll still be there. There's great fights like this going on all over the place, against new coal-fired power plants, against mountaintop removal coal mining, against tar sands pipelines elsewhere. They're trying to put one across New England, you know. I don't think they're going to succeed there either. I think everybody was, you know, a lot of people were watching a couple of weeks ago when the tar sands pipeline in Arkansas burst, and now there's a subdivision where Exxon's going to have to buy every home, I think, because nothing else is going to happen. It's very good to see all this.
What about Trans Mountain?
Yeah, there you go, another one. And the Kinder Morgan pipeline across BC, and many, many others. And that's kind of the point I was going to make next. We're actually not going to stop global warming one pipeline at a time. Though we got to fight all these things, and we got to play defense every place we can, we also have to go on offense against these guys, okay? Because there's just too many coal mines and pipelines and everything else. It's incredibly hard to figure out how to stop each one. Too much gets through. The basic structure of this industry has to change. We have to be able to put that price on carbon. And we have to be able to do it. That means that we have to break the power of that industry enough to allow that to happen. Because at the moment, we're not close in Washington. The terrible cap-and-trade climate bill that hardly would have done anything. It was as meek and mild a piece of legislation as you could imagine. But when it came up in 2009, when there were still 60 Democrats in the U.S. Senate, they didn't even take a vote on it. They were so scared of the fossil fuel industry. The last whip count before they abandoned the whole operation showed that there were 43 senators willing to vote for this incredibly weak thing. We're far away, which is why we have to figure out how to weaken the power of these guys, which is precisely why we're doing this divestment work around the country.
Bill McKibben, an environmental activist and the author of more than a dozen books on the environment. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to KUOW.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
More from Bill McKibben in a moment, 842-949-KUOW. Life Sciences journalist Luke Timmerman. Tomorrow morning we'll talk about biotech news coming out of Seattle, including nanostring technologies, which makes an instrument that gives scientists a digital readout on the extent to which dozens or even hundreds of genes are dialed up or down in a biological sample. Nanostring wants to sell the instrument as a diagnostic tool for hospitals. It'll be tomorrow morning at 9 o'clock. Forecast for tonight for the Seattle area, lows around 60, cloudy skies, chance of showers. Friday highs mid to upper 60s, cloudy, chance of showers. Friday night lows, 50s to lower 60s, mostly cloudy, chance of showers in the evening. Saturday highs around 70, cloudy in the morning, becoming partly sunny. Listeners tell what lessons they've taken away from their road trips that went awry. Also, conversation and music with guitarist Bucky Pizzarelli ahead of his appearance with the John Pizzarelli Quartet at Jazz Alley this weekend. And New York Times labor reporter Stephen Greenhouse talks about the nationwide fast food workers' strike and its prospects for success. All next hour, beginning right after the 9 o'clock news.
From KUOW 94.9 Seattle, I'm Rachel Solomon. This is Speakers Forum. Bill McKibben is an environmental activist and the author of a dozen books on the environment, including The End of Nature and The Global Warming Reader, A Century of Writing About Climate Change. He's also the founder of the grassroots climate campaign 350.org. He spoke at the Queen Anne United Methodist Church on April 28, 2013, as part of the Well Lecture Series.
I published a story in Rolling Stone last summer, and what it said was, you know, the math is now painfully clear. If we're going to stay below 2-degree temperature increase, the scientists tell us we can burn 565 more gigatons worth of carbon. That'll take us about 14 years at current trend, which is not good, but much worse was the third number, the new one that came from financial analysts in the UK who went through all the SEC filings and said, these companies have already in their reserves 2,800 gigatons worth of carbon, 2,800 billion tons, five times more than the most conservative governments or scientists on Earth think would be safe to burn. But they're going to burn it. I mean, that's what their share price derives from. That's what they borrow money against. That's what their business plan says they're going to do. They're going to burn it, and then they're going to go looking for more. Exxon spends $100 million every single day looking for more hydrocarbons to burn up in the Arctic, or where all, I mean, up in the Arctic's particularly ironic and annoying. I mean, they melted the damn thing, and now they're, you know, okay, good, that makes it easier to look for more, you know. The end of this story is written unless we change script. There's no doubt or speculation or wishful thinking, which is why we said, let's try and go after these guys the same way we did around apartheid 25 years ago. One of the few times that we've been able to stand up to big industry. And that divestment campaign was very powerful. 155 colleges and universities divested, 100 and some city and state governments. And, you know, when Nelson Mandela got out of prison, one of the first places he came was the U.S., and he did not go to Washington, D.C. first. He went out to the University of California to say thanks to students who had forced the divestment of $3 billion worth of stock. And he said, we fought for our own liberation, but in a globally linked world, we can't do this by ourselves. We need everybody. We need people pushing who have access to the wealth and the power and the prestige. And when we were doing this tour around the country in November, trying to kind of spark this thing, we showed a great video, a little video from Desmond Tutu, Mandela's great accomplice in that work, winner of the Nobel Peace Prize, and greatest, maybe greatest churchman in the world, you know, at the moment. And Tutu said, if you could see what was happening now in Africa, the famine and the drought and things, you would know why I'm asking you to take up those same set of tools that I asked you to take up 25 years ago, go to work. And the good news is that people have. By the time we were done that tour in Christmas time, there were 200 and some college campuses where this divestment fight was underway. It's grown to 343 now. Four campuses have now divested their fossil fuel stock, way ahead of our schedule, and very exciting to see. And we're still in the early days, you know. We're still in most places at the point where we're just getting the boards of trustees to say no so that we can really begin the, you know, work. I'm not going to tell you where, but someplace tomorrow I think we're going to have the first serious, you know, place where the president comes into his office and finds that he's not the only one there, you know, and that'll be good. It's very good to see. Very good to see young people taking this up, and very good to see faculty and people helping them. And it would be really good to see alumni, you know. Those, I take it some people here probably attended college, I'm just guessing. And you've noticed that your institutions continue to have an interest in you. Send you envelopes each year, you know, and we need you taking an interest. In fact, the folks who are launching the new 350.org chapter in Seattle are also working a lot to build up a head of steam around the divestment campaign at the University of Washington. I wrote another piece for Rolling Stone about 2 weeks ago, and I said that I think the time's come to give a name to all this various and diverse activity that's underway. One of the privileges of being a writer is that you get to name things, or try to, you know, and names are important. They help us understand what we're doing. It's not just a kind of scattered people fighting this here and that here and this here and that there. It's a fossil fuel resistance that's emerging all over the country and now around the world. And it knows what it wants. I mean, the world that we're looking for isn't hard to imagine. All you have to do is look at the few countries that have actually really made a serious attempt to do it. The biggest by far is Germany. Germans got serious about this 15, 20 years ago. and got to work. And at this point, more than a quarter of their power is coming from renewable sources, and it'll be 50% inside of 10 years, and it may be well past 50%. I mean, it's just acquired this incredible momentum. There were days last summer when Germany generated more than half the power it used from solar panels within its borders. This is Germany. Munich is north of Montreal, you know. I mean, this is, think what you could do if you happen to have, say, I don't know, Texas and California and Florida and New Mexico and Nevada. But you know what? There are, at the moment, there are more solar panels in Bavaria than there are in all of the United States, okay? So, it's not, the point is, a lack of technology that flusters us. It's a lack of political will to put that technology to work, and that's what this resistance is trying to build. And it's trying to build it by taking down the power of the people who are in the way. This industry that simply has to meet its match before the planet meets its match. It's not that we have anything against the people who work in it. The day that we put a serious price on carbon is the day that the fossil fuel companies become energy companies. And one guesses that Exxon, if it spent $100 million a day putting up solar panels, would be pretty good at that, you know? It's just that they can't make quite as much money doing that. The problem with solar energy, from their point of view, is it's difficult to meter the sun, you know? And so... they can make money, just not quite as much, and that's why they'll fight it tooth and nail, and that's where we need to be. I think, Katie, there's a few more pictures here, if I remember correctly. You can go past that one. That's doing. These are, actually, go back to that one. It's a good story. You know, there was a day last spring, last April, when the biggest climate denier, the fossil fuel funded group called the Heartland Institute, put up these billboards that had all these pictures of strange, like, serial killers, Charles Manson and this guy. And apparently the point was to try and convince everyone that everyone who believed in global warming was a serial killer, you know, of some kind. It's not only sort of rude and hateful and stuff, it's also just, like, bizarre logic anyway. I mean, it's like, you know, what if Adolf Hitler had believed in gravity? Would that mean that it was, you know, we couldn't do it, you know, the rest of us? But it was actually, I think the reason they did it was because that same weekend, they put these up on a Friday morning, and that day, the next day, we were launching this last, most recent of our big global days of action, which we called Connect the Dots. And we were asking people all over the world, in places that had felt the sting of climate change, to rally. We were trying to put a human face on climate change. We're trying to do the opposite, really, of what those guys were doing. Show people what people who felt, who had already felt, they didn't believe in climate change, they knew that it was going on. People in 3,000 places rallied, but these are some of them, you know, underwater on dying reefs or in places with horrible drought or with rising sea level. A few of the problems were slightly less acute, but they're there. Folks in Bellingham doing their thing. All over the place. Wildfires and in the Bekaa Valley, I like that picture. Places where sea level is rising too fast. That top red balloon is where the Dead Sea was 40 years ago. Okay. That picture just came with a little note that said, "There is no water behind our dam anymore." In Pakistan, the opposite problem. These guys, if you see the next slide there, these guys were in the part of that 20 million people who had to leave their homes when the Indus flooded so badly. Just all over the place. same kind. That's just because I'm homesick, or that's, you know, Vermont where I live. But the same thing all over the place. There they are, blocking the coal trains on the BC border. Stop there. That was the one that really got me. I mean, it was maybe the smallest demonstration and just some river turning into a street turning into a muddy river. But the reason it got me was just what those signs said. That your actions affect me, which is true. I mean, I told you before, these guys are, you know, dying as we speak from cholera and whatever else. What's wild is, though, just go back, though, to that one of Haiti. What's wild is that it's not true in reverse, okay? There's nothing really that they can do to change the way this story comes out except appeal to our consciences. They can't burn less fossil fuel because they don't really burn any now. They don't have the headquarters of the world's biggest companies to go to. They can't, you know, be... they don't have... that's us. We have the ability to do those things. And we need you to do them.
Bill McKibben, an environmental activist and the author of more than a dozen books on the environment. You can learn more and hear the whole hour of his talk by going to kuow.org/speakersforum. John O'Brien recorded this talk. I'm Rachel Solomon, KUOW 94.9, Seattle.
Coming up to 8:58 KUOW FM 94.9 Seattle, 1340 KUOW Tumwater, 90.3 KQOW Bellingham, and digital HD services. I'm Bill O'Grady. Tomorrow evening, Dina Kaye, daughter of entertainer Danny Kaye, looks back on her late father's career and on the role he played in her life. Danny Kaye played many roles, including singer, actor, comedian, and humanitarian. He's widely known for his roles on Broadway and in films including White Christmas and The Secret Life of Walter Mitty. His only daughter has lived her life mostly out of the spotlight as a journalist, author, and humanitarian. Dina Kaye is Michael Feinstein's guest on Song Travels tomorrow evening at 8 o'clock. Today's KUOW Day sponsors are Tia Higano and Jack Singer in honor of their daughter Emily starting medical school at UCLA. And Rowan Lawler, a 9-year-old, wishing everyone an epic day. And support for KUOW comes from the Seattle Aquarium, whose purpose is to inspire conservation of the precious marine environment through education, advocacy, and the adoption of sustainable practices. Learn more at seattleaquarium.org. Seattle's Gates Foundation has led the charge to push foreign aid organizations to be more efficient and effective, more like businesses. But critics say that when it comes to helping poor people, a return on investment can't be the only measure of success. How is the push to become more businesslike changing the world of aid, development, and philanthropy? We'll talk about it with Tom Paulson, founder and editor of the news blog Humanosphere. He writes regularly about global development and aid. That'll be during the noon hour tomorrow.
Thanks for listening. The program you just heard was made possible by the financial support of our listeners. Support this program and others like it by making a pledge today at kuow.org.